we present the News Quiz with your host, for the first time, Miles Jupp. And welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from the Waltham Forest Guardian, read by Neil Sleet.
A couple who performed sex acts on each other on a packed train have been sentenced in court. Magistrates heard how the couple were seen openly performing the sex acts before they got off at Chelmsford.
Well, our thanks to everyone who sent us that. Smart. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Susan Kalman and Conservative peer and Times journalist Danny Finkelstein. And opposite them, on my left, stand-up comedian Sarah Kendall and Mark Steele. So, Susan, who didn't sing a song when other people were singing a song?
Yes. Now, this is a story which may well have slipped under the radar for a lot of people. There's not been a lot of coverage. You may not really have noticed what's been going on. So let me just try and summarise what's happened. A man called Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader of the Labour Party last weekend. He got down to business quite quickly. The Times informed us he was riding a Chairman Mao-style bicycle, as we know it, a bicycle. Corbyn quickly announced a shadow cabinet, which, depending on how you feel about it, had more than enough women, not enough women, too few women, Hilary Benn, insert own joke, and Lord Voldemort as shadow chancellor. He attended, though, the Battle of Britain Memorial, and I believe he's an avowed Republican, and stood, as I understand it, in respectful silence whilst people were singing the national anthem. But to some, that meant he was doing the equivalent of holding a photograph of the Queen naked with her skin flayed from her body, if you read some of the coverage. Now, my understanding is that it's not against the law not to sing the national anthem. It's not North Korea yet. Although, if Corbyn gets his way... My favourite thing that happened, though, was David Cameron's tweet that he sent straight after Corbyn was elected, which said that Corbyn was a threat to our national security, our economic security, and your family's security. And I was glad he sent that, Miles, because that very day, a man knocked on my door to read my gas meter. And I said, "Are you Jeremy Corbyn?" And he said, "No, but I thought if I was Jeremy Corbyn, that's what I'd say." And I slammed the door in his face and I phoned the police. Because you never know if it is Jeremy Corbyn, do you? Pretending to be someone coming to read your meter as a threat to my family's security. But he's not done a lot, really, in a week. It's been quite quiet.
Well, I felt very sorry for him because I thought he got all the way through school and all the way through his first job without anybody noticing that he didn't know the words to the national anthem. And now, finally, it's caught up with him. But what I want to know about respectful silence is, what would disrespectful silence look like? And how would we know whether the silence was respectful
or not?
Well,
I'll do it for you now. It'll work well on the wireless. So a respectful silence is this. And a disrespectful silence is this.
For those of you listening at home, so it's the same but naked.
I think it's his first week. We have to remember this is his first week, so he will have to answer some questions about some stuff at some point. But I did enjoy journalists trying to get answers and he simply walked away and said, "These people are annoying me." I enjoy that. I quite like the press losing their minds at this precise moment in time because they don't know what to do with him.
So one of the brilliant, isn't it? The press are so magnificently excited. They've gone so much off on one to start with. They've nowhere left to go, have they? By tomorrow, it'll be Corbyn now plans women-only gravity. Men are going to have to float into space and they'll be late for work. Corbyn Laden plans to make all pets Muslims. We spoke to Vera, aged 81. She said, "It's not fair. My hamster doesn't like going east. I'm not fucking late." And then the end is just amazing. He's not sung the anthem. That's all the efforts of the Second World War in ruins now. We might as well have Hitler here. It's all spoilt. He's literally gone up to every Spitfire and smeared dog mess over the cockpit. Literally what he's done.
I enjoy the fact that he turned up at Prime Minister's Question. He had a wee suit on, bless him, that was the colour of kind of Angel Delight. It
was it. Did you like the question? I like the thing of ringing round for questions and stuff. But I think it would work even better if he didn't sort them out beforehand, just had a big bucket and picked them out. Would the Prime Minister answer a question from Martha in Ipswich? Who would win in a fight between Godzilla and the Loch Ness Monster?
And he'd have to end up reading out spam. He'd be like, I have another email asking if you have any unwanted gold lying around the house.
Danny, have you had any personal dealings with him?
No, actually, it's interesting. Lucy Powell, whom he's appointed to his shadow cabinet, has never met him. And she said during the leadership election, I've never met Jeremy Corbyn in the cafeteria or in the library. And even when he appointed her to the shadow cabinet, he did it by phone. So she turned up to the first shadow cabinet meeting as the shadow Secretary of State for Education, appointed by Jeremy Corbyn, and she'd never met him. And
that's funny, it's like a blind date. He's bringing sex back to the House of Commons.
I'll meet you at the Portcullis.
Well, on the thing of how many women were in the cabinet, I love the fact that the Sun newspaper was very angry about this and called it a terrible blunder and all that. And I think, which is reasonable, because The Sun, if it's known for nothing else, it's for its unrivaled, determined feminist stance. Every day, page three has got some Mexican feminist poet. People campaign for it to stop, but no, they insist. Yeah. Andrea Dworkin, Maya Angelou, they're all in there. So, of course, you know, 16 out of 31, he promised half. So that's a different fraction from 16 out of 31, isn't it? He's already broken that promise.
you were at the thank you rally for him, were you, in Islington, Mark?
I was, yeah, yeah.
It was the greatest irony, they didn't let you vote, because it was the first time you would have voted with the Conservatives, and they banned you.
Yes, exactly. No, they didn't. No, I did. I did try to register as a supporter during the Labour leadership campaign, and then I got a thing saying, I'm sorry, you do not share the aims and values of the Labour Party. And I did want to write back and say, I'm sorry, I've just been really busy. I haven't had time to invade Iraq, but I didn't. My problem may have been you're not allowed to be a member of another organisation, and I am actually a member of Riley's Snooker Club in Croydon.
But I enjoy this talk of, like, the hard left and the soft left. I mean, I think there's room for other... I'd like there to be more types of left, I think, than the soft left, the sort of cushioned left or the absorbent left. The aloe vera-infused left. What other lefts are there? Do write in. So, remarkably, this is the case of startled pensioner Jeremy Corbyn. Who, after being elected leader of the Labour Party, let's face it, you can get people of that age to sign pretty much anything, went to the Battle of Britain service and forgot the words to God Save the Queen. There is speculation that Corbyn refused to sing God Save the Queen because he doesn't believe in God and is a Republican. Following this policy, Corbyn also refuses to sing Happy Birthday because there's no guarantee a birthday will be happy, and Yellow Submarine because he doesn't believe in his heart of hearts that that is where the Beatles all live. Personally, I think that Corbyn was a fool not to sing the anthem, as if you don't save the Queen and then she shuts down unexpectedly, you'll have lost all your work. New Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn has hobbies which include making jam. Indeed, he's never happier than when he's preserving things. Strawberries, damson, the socio-economic order of common ownership. Try that one on a crumpet. Absolutely delicious. Anyway, I say, look, leave him alone. It's his first week. So what if he hasn't lived up to expectations yet? It's all a learning curve, and I think he'll probably be a lot more confident by episode two. Mine was wandering for a moment there. Susan, 2 points. Danny, who did something in the House of Commons that made some other people in the House of Commons very unhappy?
Well, there was a debate on tax credits. It came from the budget, and it was the tax credit withdrawal rate being cut from £6,420 to £3,850. So that saved £4.4 billion, but quite a lot of people didn't like it very much. And it nearly lost But in the end, the Labour Party was so distracted by Jeremy Corbyn forgetting the national anthem that it didn't actually get very much coverage. Although I say it wasn't that the media didn't cover it, it was we regard it as a respectful silence.
And the sort of cuts in tax credit, I mean, is it a good idea? I imagine your guys aren't in the business of making people's lives unendurably miserable for no good reason.
Correct. Brilliant. That is why they've chosen you to do the programme. Yes. So, obviously, it's part of a mix of policies, Mars, which goes together with the living wage and other policies for reforming welfare over time. But actually, in the end, the reason why it did get passed was partly because the Labour Party was distracted by other things and partly because the party thought there would be other policies in the longer term. So that's the reason why it was able to get through what people thought would be a rougher ride than it was.
Why is it necessary, do you think, for politicians to have to be present to vote? Couldn't they always get a vote? Why do they have to be there?
I think otherwise people wouldn't turn up at all and they would sort of phone it in from their car or something and they wouldn't have ever attended.
It'd be a bit more like the House of Lords.
You actually have to turn up in the House of Lords and walk through and then someone crosses your name off. And every time you do it, you think there must be a better way of doing this. But I suppose then no one would turn up at all. You wouldn't want that.
No, that would be an unimaginable, future. What do you think about this, Mark? You in favour of this? Of any Conservative policy, in fact? I mean, in the name of balance. We can come back to the right on this question, then it'll be objective over the course of the evening.
This would be fantastic if question time was like this, wouldn't it? I'd love it. If you should go for Dimbleby's job.
Oh, yeah, this is one of a long list.
Yeah. No, it's a terrible thing. It's going to make poorer people poor. I mean, you know, fair enough, of course, because this goes back to the crash and the debt and all that. And as we know, the people who caused the banking crisis were the poor, as we know. They were people who are now on tax credits, sort of single mums, people like that. They sort of change their kids' nappy, nip out, lose $20 billion on the currency markets. Come back. So it's only right that now they're having... that it's being redressed to a certain extent. Because otherwise you'd have to take it off the bankers. I mean, they've got nothing left at all. So, yeah, so fair enough, yeah. Take more out of it. $4.4 billion. They've probably got that down the back of their cot.
What about this, the other bill, the trade union bill?
That's a piece of legislation to change the rules about trade union voting so that trade unions have to have a majority of 40% and 50% of people in the union in order to be able to pass a strike.
Susan, you're a member of a trade union?
Yes. Yeah, that was quite a surprising question. Yeah. Yes.
I've gone rogue, Susan.
This is turned into so much.
Did you ever work for Mr. McCarthy?
I am a member of a trade.
Let me put it another way. Would you be prepared to name other members of your profession who are members of a trade union?
Isn't it that you have to, like, for a picket line, you're going to have to give all the names of everybody who's going to be there in advance and stuff like that, and they're all going to have to wear special little clothes?
Because there's also that thing about tweeting. You have to tell the police 2 weeks in advance about any tweets you're going to... I mean, one of the things I always like about being involved in riots is those things that you just do on impulse.
You have to plan, you have to go, hello, is that the police? Yes, we'd like to give information that we are planning a riot in 2 weeks' time.
It's not really then a riot, it's just like a party.
It's not what we do it for,
is it?
It's not what we do it for.
Yeah. Or you could get a job as a riot planner.
Come round to people's houses with a catalogue. Yeah. Here's one we
could
do
look
to
at those Molotov cocktails, they're not right at all.
This is a footlocker, you could put your foot through the window of that. That would be absolutely perfect. Yeah, for a couple of Waitrose. We can get anything you like, really. It'd be fine. Thrillingly, this is the news that the Conservatives have responded to Jeremy Corbyn's election by passing a welfare bill, dropping the threshold at which tax credits are withdrawn from £6,420 to £3,850, which is estimated will leave 3 million families worse off to the tune of over £1,000 a year. I think that's explained it all. Robert Peston does it all a lot more easily, doesn't he? And indeed sexily, some may feel. The cuts to tax credits will affect some of Britain's lowest paid workers, such as Jeremy Corbyn's media strategist, whose budget currently only stretches to a pager and 6 months' membership of LinkedIn, which is free. But I think with all this debate about workers' rights, we're in danger of forgetting the most important thing in any strike story, which is, of course, the struggle of a young boy who just wants to dance. 2 points to Danny. Mark, who's not hungry? I'm going to repeat that. Who's not hungry for more migrants?
Serbia. I can spot a clue. Would it be one of those other sort of Central European countries? Let me pick one at random. Hungary.
Well, it sounds good.
Yeah, no, they've not been as liberal as they might be, have they? There's sort of people coming over from... They're probably outdoing Britain, really, in sort of meanness, in this sort of an attitude of, like, oh, these people coming over here. They walk across Syria, flee across half of Asia, get in a boat, 250 of them, capsizes, then swim to Europe, then walk 400 miles, hiding from guards. Then we're supposed to look after these people who aren't prepared to make an effort. It's that. And Hungary have been quite cross, haven't they? They've been sort of, they've put fences around the refugees, all manner of things. The sort of European attitude seems to be, we should bomb Islamic State, as this is a most evil, dreadful organisation that has ever existed. And then when people flee from them, go, get back there, they can't be that bad.
It's a devastating and horrific situation. It's one of those tremendously powerless situations where I have no solutions. I don't know what to do, and it genuinely keeps me awake at night thinking, I don't know what I can do about this situation.
Well, ultimately, we've got hideous atrocities being committed, millions of people fleeing for their lives, a humanitarian catastrophe unfolding. I mean, do you think this is one of these things that will probably sort itself out?
Yeah, well, I agree with you about saying that it's a problem that you feel you haven't got a solution to. Both my parents are migrants. Both of them are refugees to Britain. So you can't just look at it without thinking, well, we've got to take more people, we've got to do what we can, and at the same time realising that even if we did that, it wouldn't be enough, that you can never do enough to solve the situation. And that is a very frustrating feeling, that feeling humane and compassionate and wanting to do everything you can will not be enough. Mm-hmm. And you're quite right, Mark, saying bomb ISIS or bomb Assad, you know, and do either of those things, you create even more refugees while you're trying to stop the situation. So almost everything that you do, you think that's going to make the situation probably worse rather than better.
Do you have a sort of an Australian perspective on our kind of inept response to this crisis?
Well, given our dreadful track record with refugees, you're behaving better than Australians, so congratulations, guys. Well done.
It's a great comfort. Staggeringly, this is the news that the Hungarian government has sealed its borders to stop any more refugees from getting into the country. Last week, a group of 40 migrants arrived at the Hungarian border to find it closed. Happily, they can be redirected to the UK, as 40 is exactly the number the government is prepared to allow in. Some people have said that immigrants should be allowed to stay in Buckingham Palace, although I'm not really sure they should be forced to live side by side with the Duke of Edinburgh, their natural predator. Two points to Mark. Sarah, who's getting ready to put on their robes and loosen their ties?
Yes, basically because there's a split between the liberal and the more conservative factions of the Anglican Church. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, is proposing to basically dissolve the international Anglican community. And so he summoned all the leaders of the national churches for a crisis meeting. And I don't know about you, but I love the idea of an emergency bishop meeting. The meeting is to decide their approach to the next Lambeth Conference, which is this once-in-a-decade gathering of the worldwide Anglican bishops, which is also the largest collection of silly hats, as it turns out. That's a very fantastic meeting because, you know, you wouldn't even bother with a PowerPoint presentation. You'd be like, I can't see because there's like... It's like 11 pointy hats in the way.
Do you think they have to wear them all the time?
Yes. In my imagination, yes.
Yeah, I think they should have to be in the bath, down the shops and stuff.
Have you ever seen one on the tube?
In the cinema. Oh, no. I was a bloody Anglican bishop in front of me. Mate.
But seriously, the big division, the big divide is over issues like female priests, same-sex relationships, and apparently many of the heads of the national Anglican churches are no longer even on speaking terms. I'd just love to see that. I'd love to see two bishops that are pissy with each other. See, I've never seen it. I've just never seen two bishops just give each other the cold shoulder, like, hi, Donald, don't you hello Donald me. So I was just saying hello, I'm just saying no. Don't speak like that, don't speak like that.
Well, that's how all religious wars start. That's
exactly
how
the... It's described as the biggest threat to the church since Charles Darwin. Did anyone see? Do you know what newspaper that was, Danny?
That was ours, yes.
Oh, was it?
It wasn't probably me, because I'm still sort of working on being a Jew from Pinner. It's not probably my expert topic, I suppose. I'm still working on the idea of Jesus being Jewish. It's not that I can't understand the idea of a Jewish Messiah. It's just a Jewish carpenter I've got a problem with.
Same-sex marriage is really one of the major issues with the Anglican Church in terms of different parts of the world not wanting to let it happen. So, as I understand it, kind of he's saying, we'll all have kind of the same name-ish, but you can do what you like. It's, yeah. I don't know if you know that in Kentucky Fried Chicken's here, they don't sell mashed potato, but if you go to America, you can get mashed potato. So it's like the same thing. So it's like, it's the same brand, but when you go different places, you can get, like, different things. So I see the Anglican Church very much as Kentucky Fried Chicken, but just a bit more religious.
Yes.
I cannot wait for you to be on stage at a synod, standing there with a bucket of fried chicken and some mashed potato, going, trust me, people, in 15 minutes, you will know exactly what I'm talking about.
It's still the church, yeah. But what you can have is, if you have the church in, like, Ghana,
right,
you can
right.
be against same-sex marriage, because the problem is Welby keeps fighting for them all to believe the same thing, but they don't. So yep. he's saying, yep. crack on, have your mashed potato. We won't have mashed potato.
Oh, OK. The one that I find astonishing is the change in gay marriage law encourages people to be gay. This is one of their arguments. And I think that can't be right, can it? I mean, since the law's changed, how many blokes have gone... I'm not gay, but I'm going to marry Stan over the road. I mean, it just seems a shame to waste a change in the law, don't you?
Well, he's trying to bring together... I mean, he's got, in the more conservative factions, there are people wanting to bring back the death penalty for same-sex relationships. And then, on the other hand, he's dealing with, in North America, where they've got, you know, they're fine with same-sex marriage, they've got female priests... And I think the question, you know, they said, oh, is this like a divorce within the Anglican Church? And I think his quote was, it's more like sleeping in separate bedrooms. That's the way he's defined this kind of schism, but which is sort of correct. I think what he means is it's more like sleeping in separate bedrooms in a house where some of the people in some of the bedrooms are being murdered for being gay.
Yeah, it's pretty, I mean, it's...
Now that is an analogy.
Yeah.
So, rapturously, this is the news that the Archbishop of Canterbury is planning to reform Anglicanism into a federated group of churches that are linked to the Church of England, but not necessarily each other. The Archbishop believes that the communion has become dysfunctional due to arguments over power and certain preferences. All 38 leaders, or what the Daily Mail would describe as a swarm, have been summoned to the Conference of Bishops next January, which one imagines, like all conferences, will involve a day of presentations, followed by the most almighty sex-a-thon. But, of course, what happens at the Bishops' Conference stays at the Bishops' Conference. Some of the heads of the Anglican Church have not spoken in over a decade because one of them hasn't finished the final series of Friends yet. Doesn't want to know if Ross and Rachel get back together. Archbishop Welby sees his plans as a last throw of the dice to avert a permanent split. Oh, come on, don't put all your hopes on luck, Justin. Do something which gets results, like praying. Two points to Sarah.
Thank you. It feels weird. It feels like every time you're announcing the score, there should be like a round of applause, and it's just like... It's too late for that now.
Yeah.
Because now it's like I'm fishing for it. But it just felt like there was this weird, disappointed silence. Did you feel that too? Like, you didn't know if you... Were, I saw a few people go, oh. I didn't want to start a round of applause.
Yeah, should there be? Maybe there shouldn't. I think it'd be better if
applause... It doesn't matter either way, just, you know.
Well, what does? But yeah, I'll try and make the whole points thing less momentous. although they are an absolutely integral part of the show. And at the end of round one, the scores are Susan and Danny have 4, and so too do Sarah and Mark. And we start round two with an extract from the Cyprus Mail.
A man has been accused of attempting to kill his wife by allegedly tying explosive material to his gate. His wife was injured by the explosion. She said in evidence that relations with her husband were not good.
Thank you to everyone for sending that in. Susan, have a listen to this. Just appalling. Susan, who's got the mettle, and I emphasise that word with good reason, to succeed in the job market?
It's a report which was published, one of these reports that's often published about things which don't necessarily matter, that said that by 2025, I think it was, a quarter of human jobs will be performed by robots. And it was a study about which jobs are most at risk. I don't know if you want to pay attention and see whether or not by 2025 you will be replaced by a robot. Anything creative, like writing or comedy, is safe, which is good. Anything with a caring aspect to it as well is absolutely safe. But data processing, things like that, are you're going to be replaced by... If you're listening and that's the kind of thing you do, sorry, but you may as well give up. So what you need to ask yourself is, in terms of your job, do I put any thought into what I do for a living? And do I care about anyone as part of my job? If you don't, then... I don't know if you've watched Westworld or Terminator or WALL-E, but that's essentially what's going to happen to your life afterwards. And it's going to... Automation happens. That's what's going to happen. Computers have already... Anyone that's been to a supermarket... I mean, I miss the ladies with the flying fingers who used to calculate how much your shopping was. I don't use the self-service tills as a matter of principle because, well, I can't work them and often can't reach them. But I... They put the card machines very high, Miles, and it's quite embarrassing to ask for a piddy-up. Yeah. It's what I think we all possibly knew, that robots are going to take over the world, apart from those of us who have a job which requires some form of thought process, such as the gift of laughter, which is what we as comedians give to all of you. And you're all very welcome, yeah?
You sound like someone pleading not to be shot by a robot. Is anyone frightened by
I bet there will. There will be robot comics. There will be.
I think there already are.
Do you think a robot could be a journalist?
Basically, I can't get robots to take over my printer, so I think it's rather unlikely they'll take over the world.
If you could have a robot, if you had a house robot that you could say, I need something printed, and it would print it for you without your Hewlett-Packard thing
it's just
absolutely nuts.
Yes. We don't need a robot that prints things. It's called a printer.
They could operate the printer, Susan. They're absolutely impossible.
Everything's impossible now. Robots have made things much harder. Miles harder. Every
can't
little
thing. Can't
get a
thing. Seat on the tube. All the bloody robots.
Can't do anything. All the new stuff that gets invented. Does this make you sound old? You know, like my son, the telly. I've got a telly, about 10 years old. Well, look at this thing. It's not even got HD flat screen something on it. And I think it's got pictures and a sound. That's enough, isn't it? And I always say, you know, the television I would love someone to invent, if it was possible, and I'm not sure if the technology exists, but it's one where you would be able to turn it on and off with a knob that says on and off. That would be fantastic, wouldn't it? If they could do that one day, rather than go, hang on, it's behind... Oh, God, where's the thing? It's behind the curtains. Who left it? Hang on, that's the remote for finding the second remote.
The only problem with that is that when I was younger, people used to rent televisions. If you remember in the old days, we would rent it for, like, I don't know, 5 a week. My mum would rent a television. And her reasoning was that you could always get it fixed because people used to fix televisions as well. And it was so huge, this thing. It had a huge back, if you remember. It got really warm and it smelled kind of funny. That when they finally got a flat screen television, A, we worked out my mother had spent £25,000 renting a television. But we had half a room no one knew existed. because the television was so huge. It's like, oh my God, it's like we've got a conservatory or something.
We rented a TV. Well, Doors, didn't they, on the telly? Do you remember the... Yeah.
We rented a TV at home and we...
This is Radio 4.
And we had a guy come round to fix it, and my father kept saying to him, it's the tuning bar. And eventually, after my father had said that three times, he said to him, how do you know that? My father said, I'm a professor of audiovisual technology. So the guy goes, mend it yourself then, and walked out. It was the tuning bar, by the way.
Everything's like that, though, isn't it? A washing machine's got about 3,000 things on it. It's easier to just put it all in the bath and do it yourself.
I used to be in charge of the white goods department in Curry's Electrical Superstore. And genuinely, when you go and buy... This is just a tip for the audience. When you buy a washing machine, buy the lowest tech one you possibly can, because they're the ones that will continue to work. All the bells and whistles, unnecessary, and it will break within 6 months. You're all very welcome.
Got a round of applause. That piece of advice just got a round of applause.
It's Radio 4. They appreciate knowledge.
This is
it's adorable.
When this is edited, this is actually going to be an episode of You and Yours.
Fabulously, this is the news that according to a report by the Boston Consulting Group, a quarter of all jobs will be performed by robots by 2025. Faceless automatons devoid of any feeling and personality. So, as ever, TK Maxx are well ahead of the game. It's certainly worrying news. The proliferation of a robot workforce is, of course, what spelt the death knell for the car park barrier raising industry. And when was the last time anyone saw a human bollard? There have also been stories about a few companies now developing sex robots. In fact, I hope Apple start making one, because that launch event with Tim Cook would be spectacular. Or a horribly aggressive and upsetting sight. Either way, a talking point. One of the companies developing a sex robot is called True Companion. Their chief executive, Douglas Hines, has defended its product, saying the physical act of sex will only be a small part of the time you spend with a sex robot, because obviously there'll be garden centres, National Trust properties, going to the cinema to see a film which neither of you wanted to see, but nonetheless represents an accurate compromise between the two films you both actually wanted to see. Sitting on a sofa and taking it in turns to sigh. Points to Susan. Sarah, who's been causing a ruckus? And the next two words are crucial. Down under.
Yes. The extremely conservative Australian Prime Minister, well, no longer, Tony Abbott, has been booted out by his own party, and the Prime Minister is now Malcolm Turnbull. And I think it's a tragedy. I think it's not often that you get a leader of a country who refers to himself as the suppository of all wisdom. Just because I don't know what your level of familiarity is with Tony Abbott, I've brought just a couple of his quotes to give you an idea. So this is one of his quotes. On immigration, he said, Jesus knew that there was a place for everything, and it's not necessarily everyone's place to come to Australia. Jesus never said that.
He did in the second book of Corinthians.
Did he? He said, you know what, guys? Place for everything. There's a place for... That was my mum. That's what my mum says. And this was his quote on Indigenous Australians. There may not be a great job for them, but whatever there is, they just have to do it. And if it's picking up rubbish around the community, well, it just has to be done. And I'm pretty sure he's looking for work himself now. It's amazing. In Australia, we've had 5 prime ministers in 8 years. This is 5 for 8, which was coincidentally the Australians' batting score nearly every test this summer. We're consistent to a T, thank you.
Time and a place for everything, and mine is right here.
That's a good accent, that was really good.
I can do an Australian accent as well.
Oh, that's very good. That's yes, I like
it's
that.
Quite good. Do you want to get in my ute?
Yes, that sounds a bit like my mum, actually.
Is it?
That's a bit more like mum.
I'd love it if I was your mum in disguise.
Bang on, isn't it? What a reveal on radio that would be. Yeah.
Hello, Sarah. Are you coming home at any point, or are you going to stay here illegally performing?
Any other voices you've got, Susan? We've been to a few places thus far.
Yes, sir. I could do South Africa certificate.
Do you know, I just realised that whole discussion we had about robots, in South Africa they call, like, the traffic signals robots, so they'll think the whole conversation is about traffic lights taking away their jobs.
I went to see Fiji play Guernsey at cricket last week.
Crikey.
I did.
Someone's doing all right.
Yeah, I did.
Don't have to be obnoxious about it, Mark.
Score, that is truly the most magnificent boast I've ever heard.
It was...
Where was it?
Colchester. They were playing each other in the World Cricket... I'd have thought, as a cricket fan, you would have known this, Miles. They were playing in the World Cricket 6th Division League. And I got chatting to two or three of the Fiji people, and they had, like, an accent that was like a very mild sort of South Africa. But it was... I just was fascinated by that, because it's the other direction, Fiji, isn't it? Mm. So where did that come from?
Where did the Fijian accent come from? Fiji.
Yeah, I know.
I wish I'd seen it. Sadly, I was watching Swaziland versus the Faroe Islands in Ilford. Strikingly, this is the news that Tony Abbott
has been...
I watched
snooker from Latvia the other day.
Strikingly, this is the news that Tony Abbott has been replaced as Prime Minister of Australia by Malcolm Turnbull after a fierce battle that one assumes originated in an argument over either a barbecue or how many tinnies the other could drink without barfing like a ruddy Sheila.
It's not true. It was over kangaroos.
Malcolm Turnbull is both Australian and a self-made millionaire, so doesn't he sound humble? But basically, what we're telling you is that a man you've never heard of and know nothing about has been replaced by another man you've never heard of and know nothing about. I'm painfully aware, however, there's probably an Australian news quiz going on right now where the panellists go on and on and on about how they've never heard of this Jeremy Corbyn larrikin in between belching.
I've had an absolute gutful... We are not all like that, Miles.
Oh, but wouldn't it be Britain, Australian news, Chris? 2 points to you, Bruce.
2 points to Sarah. Mark, what time should the news at 10 be on?
Oh, yeah, well, they're rowing about it because it's on 10, isn't it, at the same time as the news at 10, whatever they call it, the ITV one. They're both on at 10. And so there's a sort of argument about whether one of them should move, which I suppose is reasonable enough because, you know, there must be lots of people who then would be able to watch the news at 9:30 and then watch exactly the same news. Of course, in addition, there would be anything that might have happened between 9:30 and 10 that wouldn't have been in the first one. And then you can watch both. I don't know. So that's the idea. It doesn't really bother me that they're on at the same time. I wouldn't watch either because I'd be watching the curling from Rotterdam.
Who said that maybe the news at 10 shouldn't be on at 10?
It's the culture secretary.
It's John Whittingdale.
Do you like Whittingdale, Danny?
Yeah, well, he asked this question, which I thought was really weird. Is it sensible that its main evening news bulletin goes out at the same time as ITV? And basically the answer to it was yes. So you shouldn't ask rhetorical questions to which the answer is yes. I think he meant the answer to be no. But I can't understand why anyone would want to watch the news twice. Basically, I do like John Whittingdale. I worked with him for quite a while. I thought he was a nice guy. But I don't think he's right about the news being on the same time.
And it's part of the... The point being that the BBC shouldn't be doing things that the competitors are doing, and they constantly go on about The Voice and The X Factor and everything else. And I plead with the government not to do anything to the BBC until I get on Strictly. Because I think if there's one thing that will persuade people that the licence fee is worth it, is me in a short dress and heels, because if nothing else, that will keep you entertained for a considerable period of time. If you imagine me, Jimmy Cranky, in actual lady clothes, that's what it's going to look like, doing the rumba.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure this is the most robust defence of a beleaguered corporation. with all, I mean, I say that as a fan. Well, unsurprisingly, this is the latest BBC row, this time over the timing of the BBC's news at 10, and whether it should go out at the same time as ITV's news at 10, that time being, I'm sure this won't come as a shock to you, 10. It has been argued that the BBC shouldn't compete with commercial rivals at all. For example, The Voice shouldn't compete with The X Factor, Strictly shouldn't compete with Dancing on Ice, and The News Quiz shouldn't compete with Kiss FM's Drive Time show with Michael and Andrea. Before we reveal the all-important final scores... Has anybody got a cutting they'd like to share? Susan.
I do. It's been sent in by Harry O'Sullivan, and it's from the BBC News website. A woman in her 80s fought off an attacker by squeezing his testicles, police have said. The man is described as white, about 5'8" tall, between 25 and 35, with tan skin and a young voice.
Danny.
Yes, sir. Also from the BBC website, sent in by lots of people, British ventriloquist Paul Zerdin has won America's Got Talent. The 43-year-old Londoner said he was, quote, totally speechless.
Sarah.
This was seen in the Hampshire Chronicle by Liz James, and it says, rare crockery to go under hammer.
Comrade Mark.
Graham Sutton sent this in. The following announcement, he says, from the guard was heard on the train yesterday morning. We apologise to the overcrowding on this train. This is due to the previous train travelling from Salisbury to Waterloo having no driver.
Well, thank you. Let's take a look at the final scores. And Susan and Danny have 8, and so too do Sarah and Mark. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from the Handel House website sent in by Heather Tamala.
Due to building work taking place at the museum, there's no lift access or toilets, but visitors can use Handel's original staircase.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz are Susan Howman, Danny Finkelstein, Sarah Kendall and Mark Steele. The chair was Miles Jupp and the news is read by Mimi O'Sweet. The chair's script was written by Max Davis, James Kettle and Tom Neenan, with additional material by Sarah Campbell and Robin Morgan. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC radio comedy production.